Encourage me the whole way long. Make me say, ow. Ooh. What's popping, y'all, Los Angeles? What's going on, India? What's going on, Asia? What's going on? Big up Asia. Big up mi cubano. Big up Cuba. Big up Trinidad. Big up Tobago. Big up Anguilla, the British West Indies. Right, motherfuckers, look alive. Hey, yo, thanks for tuning in to the Nestorious Public Radio Show, live every Thursday night from 9 to 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and midnight to 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on SkidRowStudios.com. I'm your host, Nestor Rodriguez, and I'm not going to do the AKA because my man Simon's not here, but you know who this is. Nestorious. And we have a dope ass show today, man. We got my man, the usual, one of our usual suspects, Rich Corbin.
What's up, everybody? How you doing?
Yeah, he's lubricated his throat with some Ludens and
how
shit.
How you doing? Okay.
Yeah.
Got that funky cold Medina.
Yeah. Uh-oh. And we have two directors in the house. We got this cat, Leslie Small, who we're gonna get into who he is, what he does, and all that other stuff. E-40 movies, Kevin Hart, all sorts of shit. You know, we're gonna enlighten y'all motherfuckers. We got the gorgeous Rosemary Rodriguez, who's also, you know, a sizzling hot director. We're gonna get into that. We got my man Jamal Northern. Jamel, I fucked up your name.
Uh-huh.
Like, hey, Nick, cut that out of the show. We got to cut that out of the show. All right. Now you're going to make me self-conscious. Jamel. Motherfucker J. How's that?
Fair enough.
I've been calling him Jamel like for Jamel. Fucking all week. There's, and now I'm going to be like Jamal.
There's two L's like, with an E and then the little
Jamal,
accent.
Like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
No, it's Jamel.
All right, Jamel.
Jamel.
Got it. Big up. Big up Jamel. All right, there you go. You see, you got your 5 minutes of fame now.
Thank you.
Yeah, man. So, that's right. We're gonna be talking tonight a little bit about Leslie Small, new directorial project. Rosemary Rodriguez. We're going to talk about weddings. It's June, motherfuckers. Wake up. It's June. More weddings in June than sushi on Ventura in Los Angeles. We're going to talk about gay. Yo! Wake the fuck up! Gay motherfuckers can get married now back in California. We're going to talk about that shit. This is a big deal. You know? So anyway, that's the deal. Thanks for tuning in again. Hey, listen, if you're in your underwear in your living room right now eating stale cornflakes with rice milk and no bananas, you ain't got nothing to do with your life, take this number down, 1-800-893-9562. Listen in, call in, you might learn something, okay? All right, man. So, you know, I just get a little crazy and shit, you know? So that's how it goes sometimes. All right. We have a little audio track coming up. For some reason it ain't happening. There we go. Uh-huh. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
No. That's what I gotta do. Yeah.
baby.
Yeah. So yeah, we're gonna talk about that. We're gonna talk about a little Efezio.
Cody Water.
Charlie Hustle. That's right. All right, yeah. So I played that. I played that because you directed Charlie Hustle.
Yes.
Now tell me, Leslie, tell me a little bit about that. I mean,
well, E-40 was an interesting character. You know, I met E-40 when I was coming right out of graduate school, and I was this very proper, you know, astute sort of fellow.
Graduate school. Yeah. Okay.
And I meet my man. He says, so listen, we're going to come over to the coffee table, chop it up. You know what I'm saying? We're going to break out a little spread. Woo, woo, woo. And I'm like, I had no idea what he was talking about.
Now, this is 1998, 99?
This is 98, 99. I had no idea he was speaking another language.
He's speaking double dribble and shit.
He created a dictionary of slang language.
Right, right.
So he had his own damn language. So right. I'm trying to be cool, you know, because I'm trying to shoot music videos.
Right.
And he's talking, and I'm looking at him saying, And the one thing I noticed was that he kept, like, he wasn't comfortable with his weight. He was about 380 pounds.
Right.
So I was like, yo, and they drunk, like they had, you know what Carlos Rossi is?
Yes.
That big 3 gallon
big jug of fucking nasty wine.
Damn dollars. Yeah. Right.
That's called
balance it on your arm and take it to the side.
Yeah, that's called alcoholic training juice. That's what that is.
So, they're sitting there drinking this Carlos Rossi like it's Kool-Aid or something. Like, this shit is the best thing from ever. And I'm like, yo, what is this? So he said, oh, you got to have some. So they poured a little Carlos Rossi in a thing, and I drank, and I got so mad. It tastes so bad, I wanted to kick his ass. Like, I was... All of the graduate school went right away.
Okay. So you directed one of his music videos, or you were trying to direct
10 of his music videos?
You directed
them. That was the beginning of the relationship.
Got it.
You know, and up in the Bay Area, I was doing like Tupac, E-40.
But he hadn't had any music videos directed yet of his stuff, or he already had some?
Yeah, see, E-40 was the kind of guy that was like this. In the Bay Area, guys, what they did, they looked at the record industry and said, hey, listen, if I go and I make a record and you give me $1 million to make a record, right, what you say.
Right.
And I sell...
Even though you're going to get a bottle of Carly Rossi.
I sell 1 million records. You know, I'm still in debt.
Right.
At a million records sold, those guys would still be in debt.
Right. Why is that?
Because of the way they expensed everything to that account, right? So now think of it like this. You put up $1 million. Guy goes in. You sell 1 million records. 1 million records nets to a record company somewhere around $15 million. At $15 million in revenue, these guys were still in debt. So the guys in the neighborhood, Urban Cast, was looking at that shit, you know, because they came up, you know, doing, you know, on the streets and stuff. That doesn't make sense to them.
They're like, give me a million, that's some fucked up cocaine economics. That's like, what?
Exactly.
I gave you $50 for $0.5 grand. Where the fuck's my shit?
Exactly. So you give me $1 million, you make $15 million, and I still owe you money.
Right.
That didn't make sense.
Right.
That
didn't, you know, make... what? Get the Glocks. Fuck this shit.
Exactly. So what 40 Nam started doing was making their own music and selling it out their trunk.
Right.
So now they would sell 100,000 records for $10 and make $1 million.
Right.
Their investment may have been 15 grand. But now they're rolling with $1 million. So 40, when I first went to his house, he hadn't had a record out. He wasn't on a major label or anything. Mm-hmm. He was living in a house that he built from scratch that was 15,000 square feet next to Gary Payton, who at the time was the number one point guard in the NBA.
Wow.
Like, he was like loaded.
Wait a minute. We're not going to talk about anything that we initially going to start talking about. We're just going to talk about the economics of fucking gangster rap videos. Fuck this. We're going to go back to gay fucking rights and all that shit on another episode. You available next Thursday?
Yes, sir. Yes,
all right,
sir.
Fuck this. Because I wasn't even planning on this shit. I mean, no, seriously. I understand some of it. Like, I get it. You know what I mean? Like, I probably saw E-40 and he asked to sell me a fucking cassette,
absolutely,
and I probably said, man, get the fuck out of here. I should have bought one of them.
You're thinking they're transients, and these cats are living in life.
Right,
like,
right.
They're doing, literally, without a record deal, mm-hmm. at one point he had a record go in the top 10 of Billboard. Mm-hmm. That's how prolific from car. And this is selling records from car to car.
Right. But he's a badass rapper.
Bad rapper. But they all, those guys, E-40, Master P, and all of those guys in that little 90s
era. And Master P came out of that too? Yeah.
All those, here's where we got a startup in the Bay Area. Uh-huh. All of those cats out of that era were making hundreds of millions of dollars in the music industry.
Right.
And they was making it was putting
without the music industry.
I think we contributed some of those. We have a bunch of Master P dolls in storage.
Oh, no. I got some Master P dolls that I bought at the East Coast.
I probably shot the commercials for those bullshit.
Well, no. Master P dolls, you pull his string and he goes,
I shot all his music.
I got that. I used to sell them on eBay. Now I got them for $4.
Master P was another guy. When I sat down with him, I had no fucking idea what he was saying. I was sitting there talking to him about doing a job. He's like, hey, Ward, hey, whoa, blah, blah. And I was like,
you're like, now I know how white people feel when they come to my neighborhood and they see just black guys and they think we know what the fuck are they saying.
Yeah, at the end of that meeting, he gave me a briefcase with $160,000 in it. It's like we had negotiated to do a music video for $160,000. I had no idea. Cash.
He don't have a bank account.
I didn't have a bank account yet. Right. So he gave me $160,000. Right. Now. Right. Saying, okay. Whoa.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
You're walking out of his house with a briefcase.
Okay.
That's awesome.
This is ridiculous, dude.
It's true.
Okay, Master P, I know you're out there. 1-800-893-9562. I know you have a bank account and you have a PayPal account. Ooh. Okay. Rosemary Rodriguez, please say hi to the audience is here.
Hello.
There she goes. She's very proper. Rosemary Rodriguez is a prolific director. She's directed I don't know how many fucking thousands of episodes of TV. She produced and directed a movie that went to Sundance, Acts of Worship. And you're embarking on the long-awaited fucking project that you've been godforsakenly wanting to do this shit for like 10 years, Silver Skies. And we basically just decided, fuck it.
I hope Master P's listening.
Well, that's why I just did the segue. That's exactly why I did the segue.
But he has an extra briefcase later.
No, that's exactly why I did the segue.
Put that money to good use.
No, that's just it. I said, we got $200K. Right. We need about another $250K. Master, you got $1,000? $100,000? Talk to us.
Where is he now?
1-800-893-9562. You know you want to. Anyway, so, that's the deal. So, Leslie. Please, yes, you just gave like a whole fucking thesis worth of information on the black market music industry.
Oh yeah, it was a whole nother thing. It's sort of hip hop changed the landscape of music.
Mm.
You know, because what was happening at the time the hip hop came out. So you really have to understand the hip hop was a rebellious movement against this idea, especially for young black guys, right?
Sure.
Because like in the 80s and shit, you know, all black dudes was like either 3'2" on TV and
right. Whoa.
Blind.
Blind. Or serving some shit.
Or fucking lace and shit,
So
all of the images that they were giving to black men in the 80s was like, fuck that, that's not me.
Right.
Hip-hop comes out and says, fuck that, we rejected Michael, Prince, we rejected all that bullshit.
Right.
Like, we are men.
Right.
And then, you know, when they got into the industry, they started looking around and seeing that they were getting raped. And so, you know, they went to the streets with it. So hip hop was had a strong economic pull. Nobody ever talks about that.
Mm. Right. And well, you're talking basically of hip hop probably in the late 80s to early 90s.
Yes.
Because the origin of hip hop, rap music, because a lot of people consider the music just hip hop, but hip hop is actually the culture, graffiti, rapping, and breakdancing from the East Coast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then therefore the term hip hop was adopted by the music, right?
Absolutely,
right. In the early 80s, the late 70s, early 80s, you had, you know, Treacherous Three, Run DMC, Houdini. These guys were not rapping about fuck the establishment. They were talking about, you know, having fun, you know, freaks come out at night, you know, this, that, and the other, and the braggadocia, you know, which is emceeing, right? Mm-hmm. And then the cats you're talking about, like in the early 90s, late 80s, you know, I would say West Coast rappers,
right?
They evolved into this fuck you, we're taking shit.
Right.
And what's interesting about that is that all those cats I was talking about prior, they all got fucked. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Grandmaster Caz,
all of them.
All these motherfuckers.
Yes.
I mean, you know IC.
Absolutely.
IC directed Something From Nothing, the art of rap.
Right.
95% of those rappers, 95%, fucking living in the project still. In the Bronx. No money.
None.
Rakim.
I think what's cool is that as artists, because they're all artists.
Yeah.
Right? As an artist, it's like you see something you're going to be taken advantage of. And it's like, you know what? I'm going to own my shit. I'm going to take care of it. And I'm going to create. And I'm going to reap the benefits of my own work.
That's genius.
Like, I mean, so like you take a cat like what was his name? I did... The guy, he calls his name Luke Skywalker down in Miami.
Oh, yeah.
Luke Campbell, right?
Luke, yep.
This guy used to make...
So horny. Me love you a long time.
Right. They would mess with him about the music he was making, right?
Right.
But check this out. The distributors would roll fucking 18-wheelers up to his house on a Friday and just load it up with his own records because he was printing millions of records and shipping them all over the country and making all that dough himself. He was making so much money because he had his own enterprise.
So he was printing his own shit out of his house?
His own shit. And then but here's where he fucked up. The record industry came to him and said, oh, we could do it better. Let's take this out your hands, da da da. And his empire was destroyed. And guys,
because he sold out.
Right. He went into the other side and he sold out. But you look at his early life, his early career, this dude was printing money.
Right.
You know, Master P, printing money.
See,
These guys were printing money.
You see, I didn't know.
And then when they went in and became part of the quote unquote, you know, legitimate
machine, yep.
These guys went from making, I mean, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to, you know, can I get a job?
Right.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And that's because they sold out. But initially that rebellion, it's weird though, because there's a psychological thing that was strange. Even though they were making so much money, and I'll never forget, I was working with a music video company called Shooting Star. And we were shooting a Snoop video. I was shooting a Snoop video with Snoop and Master P. It was called Gangsta Girl, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the owner of this company was this white lady up out of Northern California. And she comes to the set this day, you know, and she's crying. I'm like, what the fuck? You can't come
Why
up
are
here.
You crying, like, bitch?
This is a goddamn hip-hop.
You white.
You
can't. Life should be right for you. Why are you crying?
Right. And so she's like, Leslie, can I talk to you? And I'm like, I'm working with Snoop and him. And
I'm
like,
directing gangster rappers, bitch. Can't you see a nigga's busy? What the fuck is wrong with you?
Exactly. I love the way he interprets for me. So then she says to me, well, you know, now here's the thing. At this time, Shooting Star was like the biggest music video production company in the game. They're probably doing $10, $15 million a year in music videos. She comes to me crying.
Mm-hmm.
And she says to me, I'm crying because I'm invisible. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? She says, well, I'm doing all this black music and I'm doing all this gangster music and my friends, people that I grew up with, they don't recognize that I'm doing anything. Like, I feel like I feel ostracized. Hmm. Now, you have to understand, like, at that time, a music video was about $350,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 per music video. We were probably doing 15 music videos a month.
Wow.
That's the kind of revenue that was coming in to
this
company.
That's a lot of cocaine.
That's what I'm... And she was crying because the people that she hung out with didn't recognize that she was doing anything of value. Mm. And we were like, wow.
Wow.
How did you transition from music videos to films or to comedy?
Great question.
Interesting thing. Master P left this company. He was one of their main clients at the time. That's where I met him. I was over at Shooting Star and started No Limit Films.
Mm-hmm.
And when he started No Limit Films, he took a couple of the directors from Shooting Star, which happened to be one of mine. I had just gotten there and said, you guys come over here. And, you know, you could do a bunch of stuff. So that's where the $166,000 came from. He came to me. I was in the studio doing something. He says, look, here's some money, come hang out with us and do everything that we do. So with Master P doing that, he didn't have a real high concept of in terms of quality of what we were doing, but you got a chance to do everything.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, yo, here's $400,000. I need 4 music videos. You don't have another dime. Don't fucking go over budget.
We don't got a white woman? Fuck it. Get a dog. Put the dog in there. I don't give a fuck. We got $400,000. We got 4 music videos. We need to shoot this shit.
Right now.
You ain't got a dog? Put a white bitch in there.
And that's exactly how you talk, by the way.
He is not exaggerating, right?
I don't give a fuck. We ain't got no lemonade pee in that bitch.
One time we were doing a music video, and I think it was Tank or somebody like that had this great music video where they had water coming down all over them and shit, you know what I mean? And it was this really sexy scene, right? So I'm doing a video with Master P. He says, I want some fucking water coming down over me. And like, he's like, bitch this, bitch that. Yeah, and then, you know, I'm like, P, it doesn't. You can't put water in a hip-hop gangster music
video.
Like,
Like P. Where is the water coming from? It's not raining in the hood today. What's going on?
So he was like, fuck that. We're not shooting anything. Until I get some water, I want to have my shirt off, and I want some water coming out in the middle of this thing. So we just took a water hose, and we put some
holes in it and jerry-rigged the shit.
And he was happy.
And we shot the thing. Yeah, it was
unbelievable.
Hip-hop music videos were great because, you know, these guys had these wacky-ass ideas.
Right.
And you would have to, like, figure out how to do it, like, now.
And they didn't give a fuck how it looks. It don't matter.
They want some fucking water.
Get some fat... some fat black asses jiggling up and down. Exactly. We don't need wallpaper. Fly in some fat black asses. Put them on the pool. We ain't got a pool. Fuck it. Put some water on the grass.
That way you can, though. You can take $400,000 and make 4 music videos that way. You know, whereas if you were going to do it with a studio, where no, we got to bring in the rain machine, and we got to do all this and that.
Right.
You know, I mean, and that's, you know.
Some of the classic music videos were, like, done for, you know, like, just on, you know, like, when you think about some of the great scenes, you know, Big Pun gets out of fucking helicopter and hits the alarm switch.
Big Pun, rest in peace.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. That's classic.
Big Pun is
a helicopter. He's walking away from it, and he hits the alarm on it, right? Like, you know, like, they just had great ideas, you know, that were so off the hook, and you just had to be able to go with it, you know.
Right. Crazy. So, okay, so music videos, and then your first non-music video film
was a horror film, and I don't talk about it a lot.
Tell me.
It was a horrible experience.
That's perfect.
I don't even watch horror films. Like, it was a friend of mine. We were talking. He's like, yo, we got to get to doing some movie shit. So he's like, he was a writer.
Was that Hood Rat?
Hood
Rat. Hood Rat.
Yes,
because you don't even want to talk about it. You know why you don't want to talk about it? Because I looked at IMDb. They fucking had that listed as Tara. I'm like, Tara? Fuck are you talking about?
Change the name of that.
You changed the name of that shit. You ain't got
So... here's where I understood how crazy the movie industry was, right? Because we had 5 or 6 ideas that we wanted to do, right? Really good ideas. Then he had this really crazy fucking idea for a horror film. So we go up to Universal. We get a meeting at Universal to talk about doing some films, you know?
Right.
And they said, okay, let's see what you got. So we go in, we pitch, you know, and we had some really good, strong story films, right? By the time I got to my car and we were driving out of the parking lot, we get a call. We really liked that horror film. Now, the horror film was about a guy who falls in love with a rat.
Right.
And uses this rat to kill everybody.
Yeah, right there, you put the brakes on. What? Bring the music video bitches back here. Get rain. Make some water.
Involved.
That sounds like a perfect idea.
All of the fucking ideas. I mean, we had really great ideas, but the rat film is what. Was a, you know.
It's an all black cast. Yeah,
Isaiah Washington.
Yeah. Of course.
First leading role.
Of course.
And you know.
Yeah.
And
how many rats did you have?
Oh, you know, that's the funny shit. In this movie, the highest paid in the movie were the rats because we had to have them trained. And we went up to Gentle Jungle and it cost us $200,000 of the budget.
Master P, come here, man. What kind of shit is this? $200,000 for some for free.
Unbelievable. So, unfucking believable.
Yeah, it was
I mean, look. Okay. So you go from that. I mean, I got a whole list of all the films that I want to just go in through every fucking film you've done. Eventually you got into directing comedy videos.
Right.
Like concert films.
Right.
So the first one.
The first
after Tara.
No, the first concert film I did was called I got the Hookup Comedy Jam.
Okay.
And it was a street like classic.
That shit must have been sold in the back of Masterpiece fucking truck because it wasn't on IMDb.
Exactly.
I got the Hookup.
Eddie Griffin's first.
Oh, really? What year was this?
This was 1990. It had to be like 99, right in there, too.
Yeah, no.
It was like Eddie Griffin was on the show. Cheryl Underwood's first appearance.
Okay.
Snoop was on the joint. P was on the joint. Mystical was on it. And we shot it here at the, at that time, it's called the Universal Amphitheater. Now it's the Gibson Amphitheater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what it was this big comedy concert with the biggest rappers.
Mm.
And probably so sold like a million
rappers
copies.
And comedy.
Yeah, going in and out.
Got it.
You know what I mean? And the craziest thing about that show was I'm sitting in a control room shooting the show, right? Snoop is on, he's killing it. He comes all that, you know, whirling down the street, smoking Endo, sipping on gin and juice. He killed it. Audience is going crazy. So Cheryl Underwood comes out. And she comes out with a bunch of strippers on stage. That's, she has these guys come out doing this, you know, stripper guys doing all this stripper shit, right? You know, before she comes down on stage. So all the chicks are like going crazy in the audience, right?
Right.
The next comedian comes out with some chicks just sort of dancing. And they started booing his ass, like, yo, get this bitch. He started throwing stuff on stage.
P, that bitch is brought naked motherfuckers on stage. What kind of shit is this?
Exactly. So they rebel the audience and they do not let the show go. They're like, you know, Maestro was his name.
Okay.
He was
a comedian?
Yeah, he was a comedian.
He ain't a comedian no
and
more.
He was the host of Soul Train at the time. Right?
Really?
So he's trying to do a set and they're like, boo, boo. He's like, come on, y'all. Y'all gotta, boo, boo. And they start throwing shit.
Come on, y'all. You ain't gonna say that shit. You gotta take something out.
So I'm in the control room doing this show. Like, this is my first big sort of concert thing we're doing. And then all of a sudden, everybody runs off stage. Mystical was on stage doing, you know, one of his songs. Everybody runs off stage. What had happened was Snoop had just left Death Row.
Uh-huh.
And he had joined with No Limit.
Right.
The Death Row cats had snuck backstage.
Oh, shit.
And nobody knew it. So when Snoop comes off stage and he's out there by himself, Master P and all his other cats. And so all the Death Row guys jump on Snoop.
Oh,
so
shit.
So I'm shooting a show and then just everybody just runs out.
Folks out there in podcast land, if you want the footage, call us or email me, Nestorius Public Radio. Email me, I got the footage. You've never seen this shit before. You've never seen Snoop get it rolled up on. We got the footage, okay?
And then the crazy, so this is the second time in the show. First, you got the people mad at this comedian who doesn't give up female strippers.
Yeah.
Then you have at the climax of the show,
oh my God,
everybody runs off stage. So now you got 10,000.
So how did you feel? You must have been like, what the fuck?
I was like, what the hell is going on? But there was a little small comedian. His name is AJ Johnson.
Okay.
You remember AJ Johnson?
Yes.
He got that place back in control.
He got up on stage, took the mic, and fucking racked it.
Killed it.
Really?
That's what started his career.
Wow.
Because that day, he was like, I mean, they were pissed. I mean, you got 10,000 people pissed.
Ghetto motherfuckers, too.
Snoop and all them, they left. They split.
Because I read that the tickets to that show were on the bottom of a 25-cent welfare juice, the little juice jugs. Like, you bought one of them shits in the projects, and you win a ticket to go to that concert. So everyone in that motherfucker was like... They weren't fucking, forget it.
So that was the first sort of big concert. And then that thing just became like a little classic in the neighborhood. It sold probably a million copies.
Really? I didn't even see that. I mean, you, Rosemary has a IMDb Pro. Yeah, I have.
It wouldn't be on there, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, it was just something that we figured out how to do it that night.
You're definitely going to come back and we talk about all your, I mean, this is so many questions.
You have a movie coming out next week.
Yeah, let me explain.
Whoa. Yes.
I don't want to not get to that.
No, I definitely want to get to that. No, but I wanted to get into Kevin Hart.
Okay.
Yeah. And I wanted to get into, like real fast. I mean, how did you get involved with Shaquille O'Neal to do those all-star comedy jams?
Well, we were looking around, and
you saw one big, tall, black guy said, fuck it. Pete, grab that motherfucker. We got $200,000. He's black. He's 7 foot tall. Bring him in.
No, we were looking around, and we were going to these different events. Like, you know, I have a lot of friends that are professional football, professional athletes. And at the All-Star Games, there was really nothing to do. You could either go to Michael Jordan's party or this party. But if you sort of just wanted to have a good time, there was nothing to do.
Got it.
So we in Phoenix, we said, well, let's just do the All-Star Comedy Jam. It started with Cedric.
Got it.
Cedric the Entertainer and Shaquille O'Neal presents All-Star Cam. No, Cedric the Entertainer still alive.
Oh, wait a minute.
You're thinking about Bernie Mac.
Bernie Mac, dude. Yeah. So sorry.
So it started with Cedric.
Can we cut that out of the show? I do that shit.
All black people look alike.
Yo, I do that shit. I did that shit before.
It's hey. Not just the white people that do it, man. Shit. Seriously, there's proof. He's Puerto Rican.
Big up Cedric the Entertainer. I just fucking killed you on the radio show. You got about 30 more fucking years to live. Unbelievable. I do that shit sometimes, man.
So we said, look, let's try to do this. And the NBA was like all against it. You know, it was really hard to do. So what we did is we found a little theater, and it was in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And I had been noticing like who I thought were really good comedians. Mm-hmm. And I went to Kevin Hart, who was like really struggling at this time.
And this was early on in his career.
Yeah. And I said, it was 2008. And I said to him, I said to Kevin, Cedric, Tommy Davidson, Ari Spears. I said to these cats, hey, man, let's just do like instead of you guys all doing one show where it's just you as an hour, let's do a comedy themed sports thing at the NBA All-Star. And I want to shoot it. And I didn't have a deal or anything. I was just like, I know if we shoot this,
you can sell it at the back of your truck.
We can sell it on the back end and we can make it happen.
You can sell it on the back of your truck and be like, Ralph's, hey, yo, you want some comedy DVDs?
The funny story about that is I think we paid Kevin that night, I want to say maybe like $10,000.
Wow.
Total.
That's pretty nice.
For that thing. No, it was nothing.
Whoa. that's his pay and profit and take?
Yeah, that was it was a buyout for him.
Buyout. Got it.
So, but that.
Shit, give me $10,000.
That relaunched his career.
Yeah.
So 2 years later, I go to do Kevin as a 1 hour. And in 2 years, I went from paying him $10,000 in one night. And when we did Laugh at My Pain, we had to pay him $750,000
right,
for the night.
Right,
so, right. So the Shaquille O'Neal All-Star Comedy Jam became this platform that sort of, you know, really boost,
right.
You know, the careers of comedians. It was a lot of fun doing it, but we had no idea that it was going to really be, because there was nothing else. There's no Def Comedy Jam. There's no place for these comedians to go out.
Laugh at My Pain grossed $15 million as a concert.
Yes.
Not the concert movie, but just the tour.
As a tour.
Yeah. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly.
For a comedy tour.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of fucking money.
Right.
You know?
Yeah,
Master P would have to sold 50 million fucking records, fucking rubber bands with his name on it, dental floss, Afro picks, and all kinds of shit to come up with that shit. 50 million. And this was what, over a period of like a month and a half?
What,
the comedy tour?
Laugh at My Pain? No, it was out maybe like 3 or 4 months.
3 or 4 months. Yeah. Okay. All right.
And so the interesting thing about it is that, like, so we got into doing there was a lot of demand for comedy, stand-up comedy concerts, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So where I started off doing films and stuff, I got into this comedy concert stuff, and it was like, okay, no, I'm getting pigeonholed as this sort of stand-up comedy director. That's not, I mean, this was just like some side stuff that,
right.
you know, but it just was like, boom. But you really can't make a living doing it.
Right.
So
you can't make a living directing comedy concerts.
No. No.
Right.
Yeah, because that's a very specific.
It's a buyout type
right.
thing. Yeah,
it's a very specific
genre
thing.
Okay. So this was your idea.
Yeah.
The All-Star,
right.
Shaquille, you know Kevin Hart, Tommy Davidson. So you do the first one. So it kind of becomes like a, you know, a package thing.
Yeah, but
hey, you want to do another one?
It was crazy successful.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we did over 700,000 DVDs. With
No, absolutely. Yeah. So then another one. Hey, yo, you want to do another one in Dallas?
Dallas.
You want to do another one in South Beach?
Right.
Blah, blah, blah.
Right. So it became this ongoing sort of brand.
So to get into the All-Star arena there, you knew Shaquille.
You knew some of the players because some of them are your friends from sports and killing motherfuckers. Right. You should just go around knocking motherfuckers in the head.
Yeah, do what you got to do.
Exactly. So,
not like Hernandez, though.
No, but I guess what I want to get at is, like, there's no real, like, oh, I know John Schmagegowitz, and he's the producer on my last film, so he's going to bring me into that film. It seems to me like you, from the onset, cut out your, you know, you carved out your niches.
Yeah, well,
not
I took it from when I went to college, by the way, and I sort of passed over this. I didn't study film.
Right.
I studied economics.
Right.
And so I always understood that science precedes art. Mm-hmm. And what I meant by that was the science of art in this sense is finance. Mm-hmm. You know, without the money to do what we have visions to do, you know what I mean? We can't do what we have to do. So I grew up in a very artistic world.
Right.
So when I went to college, I had to figure out money. So now I'm looking at things and saying, okay, well, the doors were not open for when you're coming in saying, I'm a black director and I want to do something, you know what I mean? People were looking at you like, get the hell out of here.
First of all, you grew up in Pacoima.
Pacoima, California.
Now, just real quick, describe Pacoima back in, what were we talking about? Mid-60s?
Late
60s, yeah. Early 70s, 70s right. Black kid,
yep.
Working class family. Poor. No.
Yeah, poor.
Not working. I say working class.
Working poor.
You know, I say working class, confusing it with, seriously, there's God's honest truth.
Right.
Confusing it with parents that have to work, bust their fucking ass. That's not working class.
No.
Yeah. Poor fucking
working
inner city.
6 days a week. Both of my parents worked 6 days a week, and we were poor.
And so you went to college, and you got a degree in economics.
Yes.
And, like, where, how did that come about?
Well, I was, like, I was the kind of dude that was, like, I was very athletic coming up, you know. But I was also sort of smart. But I didn't pay attention to that side of it.
Right.
But when I first got to college on a little scholarship, athletic scholarship, I was sitting next to a little chick, and she said, why don't you wish you could do your own work? And I was like,
do your own work?
Yeah, you know, because we had people helping us and shit, you know, you little tutors. And
oh, got it.
So at that moment, I became as aggressive with my education as I was on the field. And I transformed myself from, at that moment, I was really
good athlete,
borderline D, C student. And I became a straight A student. And so then by the time I got to graduate school, I was on full scholarship.
So you gave up the fucking athletic bullshit.
Yeah, you can't talk that shit to
me. Right. Because there ain't no money in that. Got it.
If the little chick didn't say that to me, it might not have happened.
And you're like what, 5'10"?
5'10", yeah.
5'10", fucking all muscle.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to look. They don't even have a picture of you in IMDb. They're like, yo.
He's too big, man. He wouldn't fit in the
yo. They're like, yo, we don't want you. Don't worry about what he looks like, okay?
Right.
But I'm gonna take a picture. I'm gonna put it on the Skid Row, so underneath my Skid Row studio episode. Nah, because my man's like a fucking linebacker. 5'10" linebacker, fucking neck cracker.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Unbelievable. All right. So we'll go.
So the whole thing about carving out a niche was to say that because I wanted to do this, I was like, I'm not going to let just because somebody else doesn't share my vision, you know, stop me. So I started figuring out ways to raise money, create relationships with distributors, but it's always independent.
Right.
And the problem with Hollywood is they don't recognize that shit.
No.
And now you come to learn it. That's like, okay, I've done a bunch of work.
Right.
They're like, we don't give a fuck.
But it's not legitimized
in
their eyes.
It's not legitimate. It's like, I can't walk onto a set and get a job.
Right.
You know what I mean? Nobody will give me a script.
Even do it like we do it.
Right,
so
exactly.
Hollywood
is way more complicated.
What you did?
Right.
It's crazier.
Because you have to go from beginning to end. It's not like you walk on a set, it's already built.
Dude.
Yeah.
Go back to the fucking example of E-40 Master P.
Exactly.
You know, on the surface, it'll look like, well, fuck, that's easy.
Nah.
My ass, my ball sack, that's not easy. That's harder.
Think
about it. If you get a job, right? If you get a job in the entertainment industry,
right.
You become a big record executive, a big record producer. You're a talent scout. You find somebody. You find Master P. You give him a record contract. He makes money for you. You make money. He becomes a star. He ain't got to do shit. He's just Master P. When you got to start from scratch, print your shit, sell it, distribute it, package yourself, do it again, and do it again, and do it again, and that's what you've done. I mean, you've gone from.
I think there's a system in place. already in Hollywood.
The Hollywood system
in place. And so anything or anybody that comes along, it's fine if you get on their radar and then they sort of co-opt you.
Right.
But if you're going to continue to be on that path, that really is almost threatening to the system that they have. There is some, you know, I met a director the other night, this guy Peter O'Fallon, who's got this show Legit. And I know him from, he was a producer director on a network show that I directed. And he's now out there, he calls himself a director-writer.
Wow.
Because he's on FX, taking the Louis C.K. model, and he's writing shows, directing them, all of them himself, and FX is low budget, but the whole thing is his. And he's sort of carving his own way, thanks to Louis C.K., another comedian who's like empowered himself.
Right.
To like, this is my deal. And if you don't go out of go over budget and they give you a little bit of money, like Master P, this is what I got, this is what I want to do, then they're okay. Certain networks will do that. And it's sort of more and more happening. So maybe there's a chance for people like us to actually do our own thing.
Right. Well, I did something like that about 2 years ago. I assembled a cast and we did a sitcom. We shot 8 episodes. And I shot 8 episodes. The average budget per episode was about $100,000.
Wow.
And it was called One Love. And it was really good. It was done really nicely. It was actually Sherman Hemsley's last project.
Mm. Oh, wow.
You know, it was a lot of bidding for it and that kind of thing. The problem was is that we had gotten money from one executive producer, and he didn't like the deal that the station that wanted to air the sitcom wanted. He wanted more.
Right.
So he wouldn't sign it. So the show never got picked up, but it was finished. But when I use that as a calling card, you know what they'll say? Because it's a funny show. It's great. It's done. 4 cameras. It's brilliant. They'll say, oh, yeah, but it didn't air.
You got a Hummer. You got a Hummer.
So you must not know what you're doing then.
Hold on.
You know, I'm sorry. I gotta see.
Hold on. You got a Hummer. I got an SUV. Let's go sell them shit.
Exactly. Put them in the. I'm telling you.
So what do you do with them then? Who owns the rights to them?
You know, the rights are just, they're there, you know what I mean? But there's a writer who created the, you know.
It's a collaboration, so there's a few people that own the rights to it.
But the interesting thing is when you see the show, you're thinking like, okay, I saw this somewhere, right? It's funny, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's done really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, well, look, here, take a look at this. And they'll say, come back to me and say, yeah, but where did it air? I'm like,
in front of your face. You just watched it, motherfucker. Exactly. Where the fuck did it? Fuck you.
No.
No, because remember, it was finished. It was done. The deal was done. It was going to air at the last minute. One of the executive producers. So it's finished.
So fucking
it's
stupid.
About to air on television. So when you're looking at it, you're seeing, you know, all the commercials, yeah. everything's there. And it just didn't hit the air.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was finished for the air. And they were going to buy, like 65 episodes. But this fool wouldn't do the deal.
Unbelievable.
So, you should just tell them it aired. Just right. Some of they won't know.
Oh, wow. At 3 a.m. on TNT back in...
But that goes to your point. Like, you know, it's like you do these kind of things, and that's what we have to do. I mean, yeah. I just believe that, you know, no matter what they say is no, yeah. Every day I wake up and I sort of think about how do I get a job?
How do I make a living? Well, how do you create your own destiny,
right.
really? So, I mean, because...
Well, how do you empower yourself?
Right.
Well, it's a business, and you're an artist, but you're really trying to embrace the business.
Right.
You're not just living in a cloud somewhere trying to do something nobody wants to watch.
Leslie.
You want to have an audience? No,
you
want
in general?
I mean, a lot of us artists.
Yeah.
We want to create things that people are going to want to watch.
See. Yeah, you want to do good shit. You want to create good content. You want to create a good comedy fucking concert. You want to create... I mean, anybody can fucking get a 3-camera fucking setup with a crane and you can get an audience to fill up any fucking amphitheater. You can get any comedian to get on stage.
Right.
It's all been fucking done.
Right.
What are you going to do that's going to be different?
Right?
What are you going to do that you can say, I directed that?
Right.
Yeah, I and this is how I did it. I got this person together, that person together. But at the end of the day, I don't think the business gives a shit about all that. You know what I mean?
And that's the crazy part, because I think one of the misnomers I think came from me was the notion of this idea that you work hard, you learn your craft, you know, you do all these things. I've done everything from single camera to multi-camera to... You know, multi-camera scripted, multi-camera live, concerts, sports. Mm-hmm. There's not been a type of format that I haven't shot well.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't give, it's who gives a fuck? They don't care. Like, that's not, that can't be your calling card.
Right.
Here's the funny thing. I was in a meeting and a kid had taken a camera, right? And he just went by a set, and he just had his iPhone. He just sort of, and then he like
he panned his iPhone, right,
and then like if you were the wardrobe person, he voiced over saying, and you would be his voiceover would be, oh fuck the director, he don't know what to do, and I should be directing this, right? So he just did this sort of little pan and sort of, you know, did these voiceovers, and he got jobs from that.
Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah.
But this like with some shit like this, yeah. Right? It's like
yeah. Yeah. No, I know. Yes. I know.
I know he can do the job, but can he get the job?
Well, here's the deal. No, but here's
the
deal.
That's another story.
No, here's the deal. Here's the other part of the equation that a lot of people overlook, especially people in our business,
right,
and people who are trying to be creative and put good content out there. What's missing is gimmick. Mm-hmm. That's the element. And that kid that you're talking about, that's what he had. He had a gimmick. He had the iPhone. Yep. It's panning. He brings it home. He don't even bring it home. He right. Bluetooths that shit to his Absolutely. Computer. He fucking, in GarageBand, does the lays over the fucking audio of the wardrobe girl, of the director, does it in 5 minutes.
And he's working.
Oh, my God. Oh, Tyrone, you did this? Oh, my God. Anyway, it's a shame. It's a fucking shame because
well, it's good for him though.
Yeah, it was great for him.
No,
yeah,
no, it's great. I don't know. Hey, Tyrone,
because he did that. He empowered himself.
He empowered himself.
He did something. He empowered himself, and he's now got a job.
Big up Tyrone, you card carrying Apple TV smoking motherfucker. Big up.
Like, who the fuck? I'm not hating
him. Well, Tyrone's the fictional name I gave to him because I was assuming he's a young hip black kid.
But you know, here's the interesting thing, and I think I think the thing that with like Rosemary, like she's one of the few people that I've spoken with out here where she has a spirit of collaboration,
right?
Right, where it's like she's not like I got this and you fucking stay over there,
right?
You know, and I think more of that is necessary as well. You know, the idea that you know this shit is not a secret.
Yeah, but you don't find that. All right, look,
no, it's
you know. You're not in a rush, are you?
No.
But I just want to say.
It's a little hot in here, but I just want to say.
Oh, I'm good.
Because we ain't going to fucking, I'm just going to go. We're going to just kick it a little bit, and I don't want to rush this shit.
Well, I just want to pay tribute to, in the spirit of collaboration, because you used the word that I love, mm-hmm. and the DGA just nominated first time ever.
Are we okay if we go over?
DGA just nominated first time ever a black gay president,
yes.
Paris Barkley.
Yes.
Who is
Big up Paris motherfucking
yes, her.
Big up, you big black gay man. Big the fuck up. Big up to the DGA. Big up you directors for having an open mind. Big up. We got a lot of gay talk later on too.
Big change of the guard of the DGA, and I
big
think the
change.
Spirit of collaboration.
No, that's a big deal. That's a big deal.
The spirit of collaboration is a big theme and a topic that we discuss right now, mm-hmm. and we have a lot more women now. Like we added 4 more members to
which
the board.
Is great.
Like we've just got it. Just it's looking different, mm-hmm. and it's all about bringing people in.
Right.
People with new energy, new enthusiasm.
Well, you're talking about, and I want to go back also. We go all over the place. I want to go back to the last project that you just came from your screening. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I want to talk about that. But you're right. Rosemary is a collaborator. The thing about Rosemary is that she's always looking for the next thing to do. Not the next cool thing to do. Not the next, like, right thing. The next thing to do, right? And she's always working. She's always doing something. She's always proactive in her own career and her own destiny, which is something that I, like, admire. And that's something it seems like you do as
Absolutely.
Well. That's something that you guys have in common.
Right.
She told me when she met you, she told me, oh, I met this guy. He directs comedy, concert film, blah, blah, blah. I said, nah, never heard of him, whatever. So we're going to have dinner and stuff like that. And she told me that you had gone to the Directors Guild. What was it? It was a dinner?
Panel, yeah.
It was a panel. And you know, it's like, you guys were talking and you felt like an outsider and blah, blah, blah.
Absolutely.
And it's like, that's, you know.
But I wasn't the cool kid on the panel. He really almost wasn't going to talk to me. That's all right. Grabbed him by the elevator. And then it's like, wait, you got a movie coming out, a Lionsgate movie being released on 2,000 screens with Kevin Hart, and you don't have a representation?
Yeah.
I'm going to try to help you because that's ridiculous.
So wait a minute. Go back to this. So you weren't the cool kid on the panel.
No, he wasn't going to talk to me.
It's such bullshit.
She was the only cool kid on the panel. You know?
So, but you see, that's how she is. That's how she is. She'll be like, this is what I'm saying. She'll be like, what? And you know, and that's how it is. Perfect example. Okay, so you have a Lionsgate film,
right?
So Lionsgate is distributing this film.
Is releasing it.
Is releasing it. Kevin Hart,
yes.
Who you just spoke about, who in 08 was struggling.
Right.
And you got him up on fucking All-Stars.
Right.
And 2008, we're talking about what, 5 years ago?
Yeah.
And that was in the beginning of his career.
No, he had been around for a while.
He'd been around for a while.
He just needed something to... You know, introduce him to a different audience.
Because stand-up comedy is right. like that. No. Well, bear with me. We're going to jump all over the place. Comedians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about collaboration. Comedians are some of the most self-absorbed. They ain't going to collaborate with you. They're hating on you. This guy sucks. Blah, blah, blah. So you look at a guy like Kevin Hart, who's fucking hilarious on like, all different, you know, If you guys don't know out there, seriously, I know there's so many comedians out there, right?
Right.
If you don't know who Kevin Hart is, big the fuck up Kevin Hart, okay? Google Kevin Hart, YouTube Kevin Hart. I guarantee you, I swear to God, you will laugh and you're going to be like, who the fuck is this guy?
Right.
Okay? And now, so every comedian, because comedy is hard, man.
Yes.
I mean, I've done stand-up comedy, and I'd be like, man, fuck this. I ain't doing this shit no more.
Yeah.
Not because the audiences suck, right? Because just because the business, money.
It's a hard business.
The hard business is like, oh, fuck, I got to suck this dude's ass just so I can get 10 minutes of stage time at this stank-ass fucking comedy club. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And then I got to be hanging out at a comedy club till 2 in the morning with these assholes that I don't want to be near them. You know what I'm saying? Like, I want to hang out with people I like.
Right.
Not people that I'm hanging out with them because if I don't hang out with them, I won't get a spot at this joint. You know, blah, blah, blah. So there always comes a point where you have to reinvent yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a comedian, especially. Otherwise, you get stagnant. Everybody wants to be an A-list comedian. Everybody wants to be a fucking G-list comedian. You know what I mean? And it's just like, when do you get to where you're going to get to? And here you come in. And you get Kevin Hart, and you saw something in him, obviously, or, I mean, something happened between you guys.
Well, what happens to me, like, my background, I grew up in a little theater. There was a little theater in a park where I grew up. And we went into this little theater and opened it up, rebuilt it, painted it. And a guy that was a big Broadway guy happened to move into the neighborhood. His name was Hal DeWitt. And he came into that little theater and taught us how to do plays.
This is up in Pacoima?
In Pacoima.
Wow.
And we had, I would imagine I probably had a PhD in theater.
Wow.
We learned everything. Because remember, this is just a little abandoned building.
Sure.
So we tapped the power into the city, got the lights going. We learned everything from staging,
called
character
Master
analysis.
P to get the water in.
All of that.
Yeah.
So coming from that background, then he would bring like really great, great actors around to talk to us.
Because there's actors out here.
But I'm talking about Sidney Poitier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about James Earl Jones.
Wow. Uh-huh.
I'm talking about these cats. Roscoe Lee Brown would come in and read poetry to us. Like, we're in the neighborhood, but this little small place, because we were trying to invent theater or reinvent theater here on the West Coast because there's no theater.
Right. It's not a theater town.
And so we were introduced to all of these incredible minds. I tell people all the time, like Barry White, Marvin Gaye. I was a kid, like, hanging out with these guys.
Wow.
Right? And so I saw really talented people. Mm. Not quasi-talented people, but people that are historically talented.
Mm-hmm.
So when you come from that environment, you now know when you spend time with those kind of people, there's something about when they walk in the room.
Mm.
They fill the room up.
Mm.
Like they literally just take all of the energy in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And a great comedian will do that.
Mm-hmm.
When he gets on stage, the difference to me and comedians mm-hmm. are, well, one comedian can be on stage, he can be funny as hell.
Right.
But you don't feel him.
Right.
You laugh,
right.
But he doesn't galvanize the room. Well, Kevin was, I mean, I work with Bernie Mac, Steve Harvey, all of these guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Kevin Monique, walks into a room.
You
Monique,
work with everybody.
All of them. Kevin DL. Was one of those cats that was way different. He galvanizes mm-hmm. the room. And when I saw that, I was like, whoa.
And he's not a tall dude.
Nah, he's 5'4".
But his
his
energy galvanizes the room. And Richard Pryor did that. Eddie Murphy did that. Like, these guys that are like are legendary.
Yeah.
And Kevin has that same.
Really?
That same. There's no doubt.
Well, I mean, I was just watching bits of his kids, his children.
Right.
Shit is hilarious.
Oh, he's hilarious.
It's simple.
Yes.
It's simple.
Yeah.
And it's shit that we've all grown up. I mean, how many times did your mother give you a stare? Right? Mama, and the way he does it, he's not overacting it. That's a gift to do that.
Yeah.
The first time I heard him, I was in the middle of a really stressful, really shitty job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just in a foul mood. And
in New York.
Teamsters, big up to Teamsters.
Big up your fucking cup driving motherfucker. Big up Teamsters.
Love it.
Big up your cooler ice cream cake bringing motherfucker.
Rough place, and I got in, it's like 6 a.m, get in the van. This guy puts on, I burned this CD for you, puts the CD in, and it was Kevin Hart talking about his father growing up. Oh my God.
I remember.
I was crying. By the time I went to work, I was hilarious. I totally forgot my troubles, and I just had, it was a great start
and
to the
and
day.
I hadn't heard of Kevin. Right. You know what I mean? And
she
goes,
I was telling you.
Yeah. She goes, do you know this comedian Kevin Hart? And I love when people say this to me, because like, I'm a comedian. So I don't know fucking, there's a million comedians. Right. There's so many.
I'm married to a great comedian, so it takes a lot to make me laugh.
No.
I get to laugh. Right. Like,
No. But what I'm saying is, when someone says, do you know this comedian? I could tell you like 5 of them, and you're like, oh, whatever. You probably know them all.
Yeah.
Right, Leslie? But so I didn't know who he was, but I'm like, why didn't I know who he was?
Exactly.
You see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Like, why?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Which is interesting about that, because when we did the movie Laugh at My Pain, I got Larry King to interview Kevin and his father. The guy that he was telling, because the father is really a drug addict who abandoned his son.
Wow.
So if you look
at
the movie.
And his father is in that? His real father?
Yes, sat him, Larry King, and his father, and he talked to them about.
For the movie.
For the movie. It's
smart.
In the movie. Movie. Larry King is sitting there interviewing his father and him talking, and it's hilarious. It's the funniest shit in the world, because his father literally he's coming off the streets right into seeing fucking Larry King.
Right. He's taking usually
like too real for him.
Wow. Right? Yeah.
Usually you take a break from reality to smoke crack. He's taking a break from smoking crack to do some reality shit. Larry, I only have 2 seconds. I gotta go back and hit the pipe in about 5 minutes. Go!
And the funny shit is, after about the third or fourth take, he's now like, well, Larry,
Now he wants to take Larry's job over. Yeah, that's funny, man. That's funny shit.
And like, Larry was like, when I called him, I was like, I just called him to see if he would do it.
Right,
you can't do nothing but ask, right? He's like, you got 1 hour. And so it's funny because he's sitting there.
Leslie, you have 1 hour.
Takes his fucking watch off, and he's looking at that mother. Now, he's engaged.
But he know. Well, his whole thing is by the top. But, there's a clock. Yeah.
At 59 minutes, you start to see, like.
Right.
But it was great.
His clock is counting back. Right. You know, most clocks go 0, 1, 2. His shit is at 59, and it starts going 58. So
what's different in this movie?
This movie's interesting because we traveled all over the world. And we did a lot of sketches, too. We do a lot of sketches and stuff. Like, in the first movie we did with him, we did a spoof on Reservoir Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did the whole bank robbery and stuff. Oh,
in the
hilarious.
First movie.
Yeah, in Laugh at My Pain. In this movie, we do some spoofs and stuff as well. We do a lot of sketches. But the idea in this movie is Kevin's a nobody. You know, he's popular.
In this one.
In America. But he's not shit overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go to places like Oslo, Amsterdam.
Stockholm.
We went all over the world.
Where black people don't exist.
Exactly.
So what is he explaining?
He's explaining all of the crazy shit that happened to him this year, right? But it's all over the world.
Oh, nice.
But the great thing about it is, in every one of those countries, he sold out. He even sold out the O2 Arena in London at 19,000 people.
Now, why is that?
Because of YouTube.
And
that's what we discovered. Like, all of the little skits that we've been doing over the years, like, we constantly shooting skits and posting them on YouTube. We're always like fishing for ideas, comedy ideas, right?
And they knew every one of his lines and every one of those skits and every one of his little characters.
They didn't know who he was, though.
All over the world.
Yeah, they did. That's why they showed
That's
up
the whole
for
point. And so...
No, I'm saying. They knew him from YouTube, but they didn't know who he was?
Yeah, they knew who he was. Okay. Yeah. Kevin, that's what I'm saying. You like, he had bigger receptions over there than he did here.
Oh, okay.
But it freaked us out because we were expecting to go to these countries. The comedy was going to be, he shows up at a theater in Oslo, and it's just him and two people.
And he was...
No, those countries are very diplomatic. That's There'll be point. 1,000 people there that'll be going, yeah, okay,
But so we were expecting no one to be there. That was going to be, the comedy of this was going to be, he goes, does a world tour, and nobody shows up. Like, that was going to be the comedy,
Gotcha.
Every fucking place we went was sold out. Forget showed up, there were lines around the corner.
They do shit. They're starving for entertainment or something.
So I got it. Initially, you thought it was going to be like that, but because unbeknownst to you.
Right.
Got it.
And because
that must have been great for him.
Yeah, we weren't paying attention to YouTube. Mm. You know, we didn't. You don't know how big a phenomenon YouTube is around the world, right? Well, in this case, because no one knew, like you could say, and you'll see there's a sketch. He's standing in London in the square, and he's walking and say, "Hey, do you know me?" And everybody's just walking by him like he's crazy. I'm a famous comedian from America.
Well, not for nothing, but the last 2 weeks before that, a black guy with a similar accent fucking shanked a soldier in the neck.
No, I remember that.
So they were like, yo.
But the funny thing is no one knew him, right? But the O2 Arena, again, we sold out because the kids that watch YouTube, it was all kids that showed up.
Wow.
Yep.
Awesome, man.
Yep. And so like I said, we were going to do this comedy thing. It was this whole spoof on nobody knowing him all around the world. But it turned into
something bigger.
Yeah, huge. And so we did other spoofs.
That's awesome.
That's nice.
Got it.
Yeah, but it was going to be, we came up with a hilarious idea. We're going to be in these fucking arenas, like, you know. With like three people laughing and shit.
That was kind of a good backfire for you.
Yeah, exactly. That was a luxury.
And you were going to record this shit and then do a concert movie back home.
Right.
Well, that shit don't matter anyway. That's funny.
So,
well, that's good, man. Yeah. That's awesome. I can't wait to see it. So when does that, air? When is the release date on that?
July 3rd.
July 3rd. That's a great day.
Yeah, next week.
July 3rd is a great day.
Yeah. And it's tracking really well. So here's our challenge, just so you know. Kings of Comedy was the most successful stand-up film.
Right.
It did $9 million its first weekend.
Right.
So, you know.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And you're going to blow that away.
And we're tracking.
So I want to know what we can do. So that's the dilemma?
For that first weekend. It's because we want to say we could do better than Kings of Comedy.
You will. Right.
And so
if you do that,
that's incredible.
Then we're going to talk about bigger things. We're gonna do a fucking flat plantain based sitcom. We're just gonna go crazy and do all kinds of wacky shit. So don't worry about it.
Right.
So July 3rd. All right. So July 3rd that's a fucking great date.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's gonna be released in New York, in Los Angeles.
It's released nationwide.
2,000
theaters.
2,000 theaters. 2,000 theaters.
That's
a
big fucking release.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. You said 2,000 theaters before, but I'm thinking, okay, the big cities.
No. That's a major release.
Fucking A, man.
Yeah, that's a major
fucking
release.
Fucking A.
Yeah.
Big up Lion's Gate! Big up Lion's Gate for entrusting 200,000 motherfucking theaters! It was a black box! Big up!
Exactly.
It's 2,000, but I said 200,000, okay?
All good.
Caller, how are you?
Oh, wait.
Oh.
I can't hear you. Am I on the air? It's Maria.
Hey, hi, Maria.
How are you?
What's going on?
I'm really enjoying the show, which is going overtime, so I'm glad I got it, but I actually have a question.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
The question's for both Rosemary and your other guests, and that's basically...
Leslie Small.
Yeah, Leslie Small. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I got his name wrong. Okay, so here's the question. Knowing both of their work, it's like you can put up all these wonderful things on YouTube and everything, but when you finally get hired to do so-called legitimate work, you know, that you get paid for and DGA covered and all that, it often isn't in the voice that you have created. Basically, you're going to live dual lives for a while to do this kind of hey, work. How do you handle that? Because it's kind of a pain in the ass, and you're going to get known for one thing and get hired to do maybe kind of bland stuff.
Well, I can tell you that's the motivation for why I want to make a movie this summer, why I'm going to empower myself to make a movie.
Hey, Maria, do you have porno on in the background? I hear
some... No, I have my iPad with you guys on it.
Oh, that's what it sounds like.
I thought you were watching, like, Scandinavian porno. Because it sounded like
that's
that.
How you guys sound on an iPad.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. I'm sorry.
I think we're always trying to, I'm not going to speak for Leslie, but I'm always trying to find ways to express who I am as an artist, even within the realm of a show that's somebody else's. Because we're all storytellers, and so you're handed a script, and you have you have scenes that you have to do, but you have your own vision for it. So I think you sort of run with that as long as you can, and then you get squashed for as long as you can, and then right now I'm just in a place where I can't do that right now. I really need to do my own thing.
Yeah, and my experience is different than Rosemary's, because Rosemary's been hired to do those kind of things. Part of what we do, or what I do, is come up with something that I think is hot to do, and then we go try to figure out how to do it. It's less security. There's like we don't make a lot of money. There's not the financial security there, but it's expressive. But the difference is, I may do one or two projects every couple of years because it takes time to raise the money to get it done. Da 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 da. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're working in the studio system, you could be doing 10 or 15, 20 projects a year. So
ideally, but maybe not.
That's what I'm saying. So
with all the cock blocking that goes on.
Yeah. So the best case world would be to be able to do some stuff in the studio system and at the same time do like what Rosemary's doing this summer. And go create something that's your baby that you're going to give birth to and that you're going to see through. So I think that it's a combination of the two that makes it
work. I think it's really important, though, because I started out making my own movie first and then just with
our own money.
With our own money, like making a feature first and having that experience as an artist first. Right. And then sort of navigating going inside the business and like trying to move my way through that. So, but I wouldn't want to just be in that system without having had that experience. Because then I wouldn't know who I was as an artist. Then I wouldn't know how to like push against what was given to me and make it my own. Which a lot of people do. And I know people have been like on shows and TV directors, even a comedy director I know has just done comedy for TV and then was given a feature and didn't even realize that she could make it her own. Like, she was waiting for people to sort of be like...
What do you do?
Looking around, like, well, is this okay? Is this okay? And it's like, no, you're a movie director now. Like, go. But she didn't know. She learned that lesson the hard way.
Yeah. Who was that?
It doesn't matter.
No. I want to know.
No, no,
I want to know so I can introduce her to Master P.
Introduce me to Master P.
I know.
Here's a question.
Go for it.
For Leslie, because I know, Rosemary, because I've worked with you and I love you and all that, and you are trying to create your own work for television as well. Leslie, would that appeal to you if you were given a chance to create some, half-hour comedies or a dramedy or something? Because all the comedians.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, I think there's room for it. I mean, the comedy, people love to laugh. I love to laugh. And I mean, I think there's always room for comedy, we've tried that and we're going to keep trying until we get something on the air. Definitely. I think, again, getting a show on the air, being able to create characters and design them and then, give them life over 5 years would be a wonderful journey. I mean, that's just a great thing to do. I mean,
can you put that series that you created that's sitting nowhere? Can you put that on YouTube?
I'm about to try to figure that out. Yeah, because they can't do anything to me. I want to.
How about webisodes? How about like quality webisodes? Because that's so much more of the playing field now. And some of those, I produced a couple of webisodes last year that were animated, but those can be glommed together as half hours or 20 minutes sometimes, and would have a half hour life as well as 10 minute segments, 7 minute segments.
Yeah, I did a webisode last year. It's called Preacher's Wives. It was really funny. I did it for Google. The problem with webisodes, though, is that most of the stuff that I do has to have a return to it. because I actually go out and raise money. And so when you're raising money, you know, people want to make their money back. And so one of the stumbling blocks with a webisode is it's hard to sort of convince people that there's, you know, we're just doing this. And
how do you generate revenue?
Yeah. So one of the problems that you have in the independent side is that when you're raising money and you don't have like some major corporation or something behind you, you've got to do something that is sellable, you know. Right. And, mm-hmm. and the moment someone loses money with you, they're not coming back to you, and they will tell people that they lost money with you. So part of the sort of thing that I, you know, have to
So when you say it has to be, some of it has to be sellable.
Yes.
So that kind of gave, not that you said this, but it kind of gave me the idea that maybe at that point there may be some sort of compromise.
Absolutely.
So,
for instance, like I'll have a guy like Baron Davis, for instance, basketball player, came to me one day. You know, he comes from South Central. He wanted to do something. He wanted to do this project about gangs in L.A. and stuff, right? And I was like, yo, Baron, you know, and he's going to put the money up and everything, right?
Right, right.
And I said to him, you know, the problem is that Walmart controls 65% of the DVD business.
Right.
And if you can't get a film into Walmart, you're not getting your money back.
And you ain't getting your
fucking
gang film.
So if you got some gangster stuff that's, and you can't get it into Walmart, then no matter where it goes in its first showing, whether it's paid television or whatever.
If you get gangster stripper preachers,
it's not
then you
happen.
Can get that shit into Walmart. But just like a documentary about gangsters and gangbangers,
it's not going to happen. And so I had to walk away from that project because the one thing I know
that,
is if I couldn't have sold that, no matter what, he would have pointed his finger at me and said, it's my fault.
Right.
And even so, you know, with the tapestry. So you sort of have to know the lay of the land as well in terms of when you produce something independently, what's the market, who are the buyers, and can you get to it?
And who are the doorkeepers?
Right.
Because that's a doorkeeper. That's
so
a gatekeeper.
The only reason why Shaq became part of Shaq's All-Star Comedy Jam is because of his brand. I used his brand. He didn't. I financed that. I wouldn't raise the money for it. And I gave him 10% and gave him a check to be able to use his name and Cedric's name. And then that, you know, the guy over at Showtime loved Shaq.
Right.
So when I found that out, I went to Shaq. Would you brand it? Boom, boom. When I took the Showtime, they were like, yeah, of course we'll do it.
This comedy special is, is milk chocolate black approved. Come on, kiddies. You can come close to us, black guys. We won't kill you.
I got a question though. What about straight to Netflix or Hulu or these other places? I mean, I know you probably get like a package deal. Okay, you get 120 showings. They give you, you know, however much every time.
Any distribution deal that you get is going to come with what they call your digital. Like, so for instance, you know, if I do something on Showtime is in bed with Netflix. They have a partnership.
Right.
Right. So they cross promote and cross advertise. So you're looking at that. Netflix now is producing their own shows. Yeah. Like they're putting up their own money. So like even with the project that you guys are doing, I mean, you should go take a meeting with Netflix because they're now trying to get into more programming. They have a lot of money.
So you could just take it right to Netflix.
Absolutely. So again, all of those options in our world is, and the independent side, it's really about being an entrepreneur, understanding where the different, you know, outlets are, and then creating relationships where you can go in and talk to people.
Yeah. Right. Interesting.
The problem is they'll say to you, well, we'll consider it when we see it. Mm-hmm. And that's always a problem. In other words, they won't say, yeah, I like the idea. Here's a negative pickup or anything like that, or we'll guarantee that we'll
distribute. So then you take your sitcom and then take it to them and they see it and they go, where did it air?
Right. Exactly.
Well, so what would you do, shoot a scene or something as proof, concept or something like
that? No, for me, I just go shoot the project. If I believe in it, I'll go shoot the project. And I just try to attach as many variables to it as possible to make it sellable. And that's where the compromise come in. I may find this great actor who does a scene and he's a great actor, but yeah, his name ain't gonna get a distributor to come on board. So I gotta say, you know.
You gotta say like,
bye.
We got some shave ice. Hey, yo, P, bring some water.
I'm going to get out.
Bring some water. The ice is melting.
We got this back of a truck.
Right. Like, I've run across many really talented people that I just couldn't do anything with because, again, in my side of it, I have return. I have investors that have to make money back.
That's interesting. I mean, that's very.
And that's real.
I mean, you have a lot. You have a lot of experience.
Right.
From many, many areas. And I'm wondering, have you ever thought or do you ever think that you would be a teacher? Like to teach not financing, but the business of producing, the business of I don't say filmmaking, but the business of business producing.
And that's what it is, the business of producing. And I could, but you have to get some notoriety, and I don't have that yet.
Right.
But, you know, at
well,
some
let's
point.
Shoot somebody.
Yeah.
Live from San Quentin, Leslie Shaw, teaching the first in 50-part series of how to produce a film in this biatch.
Shoot somebody. That's hilarious.
That's what you have to do.
That's what you
right?
gotta do. That's what you gotta do. I mean, yo, talk about what the fucking viable ingredient is. So you gotta do what you gotta do. Yeah. But no, we don't gotta kill nobody. We wanna live. We wanna be able to buy ice cream and drink whatever we wanna drink and bask in the glory of the freedoms of being an American. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I wanna be able to say, God damn, that TV shit sucks. And, you know, I want to be able to say that, not be forced that, you know, you're behind. Yeah.
We got to get Nestor on his own, like, you know.
Do we ever?
Yeah.
We got to get him out of the house more.
First, what we got to do is we got to produce that idea that you had about doing a show on the late Richard Pryor's property.
Absolutely.
That's what we got to do.
That's the next thing up.
You know, I had Mason Pryor 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
On our show here. I was telling him about the story of the pool.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's like the fucking, he's like the fifth kid.
Right.
Like, yeah, in between wife number five.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. Yeah.
Crazy shit.
Yeah.
Anyway, Maria, did you have any more questions?
She's gone.
Oh, she's gone.
She's gone, yeah.
Oh, okay. Shit. Where the hell am I?
I don't
Where
know.
Was I?
I don't know.
She said, Maria! Enough asking all the producer questions! Big the fuck up with the sociological bullshit in the background! Hey, man, I don't know about you guys out there in your underwear, but we're having a good time here at SkidRowStudios.com.
This is hot.
I just want to say something, you know, a mid-show plug. I don't know how long this show is going to go because we got some topics. But we're on live every Thursday night from 9 to 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and midnight to 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So, you know, tell your people about it. Go to iTunes, man. Go to iTunes, hit Nestorius Public Radio under podcasts, and check out an episode. And if you subscribe to that shit. You know what I mean? Go to our website, tell your people.
Yes.
NestoriusPublicRadio.com. Go to Twitter. Fuck it, you ain't got nothing better to do. Go to Twitter.
Even Nestorius, if you don't listen to it, just download
just
that.
Just fucking
shit.
Go to Twitter, Nestorius NYC. Fucking do it. Hey, while you're at it, Facebook.com/ Nestorius Public Radio. Just do that shit. Okay, now back to the show. All right.
I love that.
All right. So, but I had a question. Larry King. So you call Larry King.
Mm-hmm.
We went all over the place, but that was juicy. So you get Larry King. You call Larry King. He goes, you got 1 hour. Leslie, you got 1 hour.
1 hour.
So, okay. I don't get that. Like, you just call him. Where's he at? Like, can I call Larry and ask him if I can have an hour?
No. One of the ADs, assistant directors who were working on the show, was when he was on CNN, was his set girl.
Mm.
And so I was like, yo. And she's like, I can get you the number, but you got to call him, right? So she got the number and I called
him. So she got the number.
Yeah,
got it.
Yeah.
That was a Master P moment.
Yeah. It's always.
Hey, yo, P!
Yeah.
Could you get Larry in this motherfucker? Got it.
Exactly.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right, listen. So that's pretty dope. That's pretty dope. Well, we're gonna talk about some weddings. We're gonna talk about weddings. You know, not that we need a segue, but we're gonna talk about weddings. It is June.